top stories, day 11 of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Moscow resumes its offensive in Ukraine following the failure of an agreement on evacuating civilians. The Russian president says sanctions against Moscow are equivalent to a declaration of war, as he warns against any attempt to impose a no-fly zone over Ukraine. And Iran, as well as the IAEA, release a joint statement agreeing on a roadmap to resolve all outstanding issues by late June. Welcome to the program. Russia says it has resumed its offensive in Ukraine after a one-day ceasefire on the 11th day of the conflict between the two neighbors. Russia's defense ministry says the resumption comes in the light of the Ukrainian side's unwillingness to influence nationalists or extend the ceasefire. Moscow announced the ceasefire in the besieged port city of Mariupol, as well as the nearby town of Volnovakha, to allow civilians to evacuate. However, Moscow accused Ukrainian nationalists of preventing civilians from leaving and rendering two humanitarian corridors useless. But Ukrainian officials accused Moscow of violating the truce and shelling Mariupol. Now Russian forces are inching closer to the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, with the Russian president warning against attempts to impose a no-fly zone on Ukraine.
Any country that seeks to impose a no-fly zone will be considered by us to have entered the conflict. Imposing a no-fly zone will have colossal and catastrophic consequences, not only for Europe but also the whole world.
Putin says Western sanctions are akin to a declaration of war. He reiterated that his country aims to defend the Russian-speaking communities in Ukraine through demilitarizing and denazifying the country. Meanwhile, Ukrainian leader or lead negotiator says talks between Moscow and Kyiv to seek a way to end the conflict will resume on Monday. The last round of peace talks between the two sides failed to yield any results. According to the UN, the conflict that began on February the 24th has so far claimed more than 350 civilian lives and injured over 700 people in Ukraine. The UN Refugee Agency has reported the departure of 1.3 million refugees from Ukraine so far. Let's take a look at where the battle lines are drawn in Ukraine and what parts of the country have already fallen to Russia. Russia has been attacking Ukraine from three directions: north, east, and south. Russians are continuing attempts to encircle Kyiv, advancing on its eastern outskirts and launching more aerial attacks in the capital. Kharkiv and Sumy in the east have also come under heavy shelling. To the south, Russian forces have renewed their ground offensive in the west from Crimea toward Odessa. They're currently focusing on advancing from Kherson to Mykolaiv, after seizing the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. Kherson was the first major Ukrainian city to fall to Russia. Western states have imposed what they called unprecedented sanctions on Russia over its ongoing military operation in Ukraine. Sanctions hit Russian banks and financial institutions as well as energy sector. The West, at the same time, has refused to send troops to Ukraine or declare the country's airspace a no-fly zone. Now, who is likely to come out on top in this war? Watch this next report.
Russia's decision to attack Ukraine has ushered in a new era in its relations with the West. The United States and its allies are supplying Ukraine with arms and providing it with intelligence to fight Russian troops. But they're not directly involved in the clashes.
The only way to actually implement something like a no-fly zone is to send NATO planes into Ukrainian airspace and to shoot down Russian planes. And that could lead to a full-fledged war. In Europe, President Biden has been clear that we are not going to get into a war with Russia.
Of course the U.S. doesn't want that, because if a war breaks out between the West and Russia, the concept of mutually assured destruction will be on the table, meaning that the two sides, both nuclear powers, will be risking total annihilation. To avoid the doomsday scenario, the West has resorted to another form of warfare, the economic type. The United States and many of its allies have announced unprecedented sanctions on Russia, targeting its financial, banking, and oil and gas sector, among others. These include sanctions on Russia's central bank, exclusion of several Russian banks from the SWIFT payment system, and a ban on Russian banks and companies' access to Western capital markets. In other words, Russia's engagement in dollar-denominated business will be severely affected. But let's not forget that for every action, there will be an opposite reaction.
Look, the dominance of the dollar has afforded America great global power, but it is now under real threat as never before, as Russia, China, and others economically challenge the US. Many are now seeking to ditch their dependence on the dollar, as Washington has continued to abuse its status as issuer of the world's reserve currency for decades, really, since after the Second World War.
Russia has already been working on plans to reduce its dependence on the trade in the dollar.
2014 move by the Crimean Peninsula to rejoin Russia and subsequent independence calls in eastern Ukraine triggered tensions between Russia and the West. A number of countries, among them the U.S., imposed sanctions on Moscow, including those hitting Russian economy. In response, Russia considered plans to stop using the U.S. dollar in its trades, a move also joined by China later on. Will that measure be successful, and how will it affect the global economy?
Russian President Vladimir Putin visited Beijing for the opening of the Winter Olympic Games in China in early February and met with his Chinese counterpart. It was President Xi Jinping's first face-to-face meeting with another head of state in nearly 2 years, which highlights the importance of the visit. The two leaders discussed the need to broaden bilateral trade in national currencies due to the unpredictability surrounding the use of the dollar. Russia has been pursuing the policy for a while. Back in April 2021, the share of Russian exports in dollars fell below 50% for the first time. Moscow's trade with Beijing is mostly responsible for the dive. There's room for improvement, though, as a majority of trade between China and Russia is done in euro, with just over 30% of the transactions conducted in their national currencies. The sweeping sanctions on Russia may push China to speed up measures to break with the U.S. currency and create its own means of payment. The obvious option is the yuan, which is getting stronger than ever. In July, international trade in the Chinese currency set a new record, with many predicting that at this rate, the yuan will become the world's third strongest currency by 2030.
Beijing has been actively encouraging the use of its currency in trade transaction, especially under its massive Belt and Road Initiative, with China recovering more strongly than other big nations after the COVID crisis that we've had. Foreign capital has been flooding in too as Beijing opens its financial markets.
This means only one thing. Given the economic alliance between China and Russia, the sanctions might temporarily hurt Moscow, but in the long run, the West will be disarmed of its economic pressure tool.
Iran and the International Atomic Energy Agency have issued a joint statement following a trip by the agency's director general to Tehran. In line with their resolve for expanding their cooperation, the two sides have agreed on the following.
The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran will provide to the IAEA no later than the 20th of March 2022 written explanations, including related supporting documents, to the questions raised by the IAEA which have not been addressed by Iran on the issues related to three locations. Within 2 weeks after receiving the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran's written explanations and related supporting documents, the IAEA will review this information and will submit to the AEOI any questions on received information. Within 1 week after the IAEA has submitted to the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran any questions on such information, the IAEA and the AEOI will meet in Tehran to address the questions. Separate meetings will be held for each location. Upon completion of the activities set out in the paragraphs 1 to 3 above and following the correspondent evaluation by the agency, the Director General will aim to report his conclusion by the June 2022 Board of Governors.
The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency held a press conference shortly after arriving in Vienna from the Iranian capital, Rafael Mariano Grossi said there is no predetermined outcome in the agency's investigation of open issues in Iran.
Artificial deadline. There is no predefined outcome. There is not predefined name for what I am going to do, which is the right way to proceed. We have to be left alone in our professional work, and we will determine with the experts at the Safeguards Department. We are going to be evaluating what we have and what it is feasible in that regard. So no politics here.
Grossi expressed hope that the IAEA will resolve the remaining issues with regard to Iran by June. However, he noted that more time might be needed. Grossi said he expects Iran's foreign minister to return to Vienna for the conclusion of the talks on reviving the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. He said that the IAEA's process of resolving the remaining issues with Tehran is not likely to be mentioned in a possible agreement between Iran and the P4+1. While in Tehran, Grossi held what he described as fruitful talks with the head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization.
Head of the UN Atomic Watchdog, Rafael Grossi, was once again in Tehran in less than 3 months to resolve what he called important obstacles in the way of concluding the Vienna talks, which are ongoing between Iran and the P4+1, with the aim of reviving the 2015 deal. In a joint presser, Grossi and head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, said they agree on a roadmap to resolve all the IAEA questions about Iran's nuclear program by late June.
It's a real pleasure to be back in Iran, in Tehran, and with President Islami, with whom we had a very fruitful and intense exchange this morning.
We have agreed to provide the IAEA by June 21st with documents related to outstanding questions between Tehran and the agency.
The IAEA has been seeking answers from Iran on traces of uranium it has allegedly found in old Iranian nuclear facilities. Falling in the category of the safeguards issues, this topic seems to be a major sticking point, blocking an agreement in the ongoing Vienna talks. And as Grossi described, it's intertwined with the fate of the discussions in Vienna.
They are very closely interrelated, and it would be difficult to believe or to imagine that such an important return to such a comprehensive agreement like Barjam would be possible if the agency and Iran would not be seeing eye to eye on how to resolve these important safeguards issues.
Iran has vehemently dismissed the IAEA's safeguards narrative as a political claim, calling on the nuclear watchdog to stick to its technical task and avoid being influenced by, quote, political lobbying.
I urge Mr. Grossi that political influence and lobbying should not impact the decisions of the IAEA. Iran and the IAEA should follow their issues in a completely professional way and behave within the framework of expertise.
Grossi's visit to Tehran is seen as a major push to sort out the last differences in the Austrian capital, which has hosted numerous rounds of talks to remedy the crippled 2015 deal. In 2018, then-US President Donald Trump pulled Washington out of the accord and reinstated sanctions against Iran. Tehran, in return, scaled back its compliance with part of the agreement. Both Grossi and the Iranian atomic chief agreed that their meeting was fruitful. This could mean that another roadblock has been removed, and negotiators in Vienna will only have to cross the T's before a final conclusion is reached. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Reactions are pouring in following a deadly suicide bombing that devastated a Shia mosque in the northwestern Pakistani city of Peshawar on Friday. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the bombing. He said places of worship should be safe haven not targets of attacks. Iraq's top Shia cleric Ayatollah Ali Sistani denounced the tragic incident as well. He called on Islamabad to tackle terrorist groups and not allow them to commit crimes against innocent people, especially religious minorities. Iran said the attack was aimed at sowing discord among Muslims, and the European Union slammed the bombing as a heinous crime. The blast targeted worshippers during Friday prayers, killing nearly 60 people and injuring dozens more. The Daesh terrorist group claimed responsibility. Journalist and political commentator Sayyid Mohsen Abbas says terrorists in Pakistan are so ruthless that they do not even spare children.
77 attacks were launched in the first four months of 2021. And it's not unknown that they target even children. I mean, in Kabul, there was a car bomb that hit 85 people who were killed, but it was actually 300 others injured, and it was a girls' school they were targeting. So you see, they're very ruthless. Their origins are traced to 2015, when they had apparently broke away from the Taliban mainstream with a very hardline, ideology, and for them the Taliban weren't hard enough in terms of Sharia or any of the ideological side of things. But what's really been a game changer, where the US, for instance, and even the Zionists and RAW, the Indian agencies, are implicated, is that there was a huge influx of around 5,000 to 10,000 fighters from Iraq and Syria that joined the IS Khorasan ranks and swelled them. And since then, they've been the primary thorn in the side of now, of course, Taliban, but of course the Pakistan intelligence services, who've been doing huge operations to keep them under control.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the United States, a narrow and unanimous decision. The Supreme Court justices ruled that a 1978 law governing national security surveillance did not displace the state secrets doctrine. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Adam Liptak. The piece is titled, Supreme Court Sides with FBI in Case on Spying on Muslims. The U.S. Supreme Court on Friday, 4th of March 2022, unanimously rejected an argument that could have limited the sweep of the state secrets doctrine in a case arising from the surveillance of Muslims in Southern California, United States, in 2006. The decision by the U.S. Supreme Court came a day after the justices weighed in on another case involving the state secrets doctrine, which sometimes requires the dismissal of lawsuits that would disclose information that could harm national security. In a fractured decision on Thursday, 3rd of March, the Supreme Court ruled that the doctrine barred Abu Zubaydah, who was waterboarded more than 60 times and tortured at Guantanamo Bay and is being held without charge at Guantanamo Bay, from obtaining testimony from two CIA contractors who were instrumental in his brutal interrogations. Friday's ruling was more modest than technical. It concerns surveillance undertaken by Craig Montale, an FBI informant that failed to produce any public evidence of wrongdoing. To the contrary, after Mr. Montale started talking about violence at a mosque in Irvine, California, a community leader contacted the FBI to report him. Three of the American Muslim men Mr. Montale spied on sued the FBI and the agents responsible for directing him, claiming, among other things, that their right to exercise their religion had been violated in the United States. The government moved to dismiss those claims, invoking the state's secrets privilege and saying that disclosure of the information it needed to mount a defense to the lawsuit would threaten America's national security. Meanwhile, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit ruled in favor of the plaintiffs in 2019. The appeals court said that a provision of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, of 1978 established procedures for considering national security information and that the trial judge should have used them instead of dismissing the case after the government invoked the state secrets doctrine. Congress intended FISA, or Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, to displace the state secrets privilege, Judge Marsha Berzin wrote for a unanimous three-judge panel of the appeals court. Justice Samuel Alito, writing for the U.S. Supreme Court, said that was an improper reading of FISA. There was no indication, he wrote, that Congress had meant to affect the privilege. FISA, or Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, makes no reference to the state secrets privilege, he wrote. It neither mentions the privilege by name nor uses any identifiable synonym, and its only reference to the subject of privilege reflects a desire to avoid the alteration of privilege law. The statute, moreover, serves a different purpose than the privilege, he wrote. Under FISA, he wrote, the central question is the lawfulness of surveillance. But, Justice Samuel Alito added, we have never suggested that an assertion of the state secrets privilege can be defeated by showing that the evidence was unlawfully obtained. Supreme Court Justice Alito wrote that several important questions remain to be decided by the appeals court in the case FBI versus Fazaga, number 20828. Including the fundamental one of whether the state secrets privilege applies. Brian Frazel, a lawyer with the Constitutional Accountability Center, which filed a brief supporting the Muslim men subjected to the surveillance, said the ruling could have been worse. While we are disappointed that the Supreme Court did not recognize that FISA displaces the state secrets privilege, he said in a statement, we're relieved that the court stopped there, leaving other questions open in a way that may allow for accountability in this and in other cases.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone. Today, on the eve of the auspicious birthday anniversary of the Prophet's younger grandson, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, we present you a thought-stimulating description about our eventual fate, that is, death. I advise you to adhere to God wariness, warn you against the difficult days, and show you the signs of God. The feared, that is death, is about to come, with its frightful arrival, drastic befalling, and horrible taste. It will lap your souls and impede you from acting. As long as you enjoy sound physique and enough time, take the initiative in acting, because you may suffer the sudden visit of death that takes you from the surface of the earth to its inside, from its highest point to the lowest, from its affability to its loneliness, from its ease and light to its gloom, and from its wideness to its narrowness, where the intimate friend cannot be visited, the ill cannot be called on, and the seeker of help cannot be aided.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's topic, housing in Islamic culture. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's topic, we will talk about the topic of housing in the Islamic culture. What we can see in the Islamic teachings is that the Islam praises having a big house for those who need it, for example, those who have more children, whose family is big. On top of that, there are some people who require, lifestyle is in a way that they require a big house to live in a big house, so they can have it and it is praised. But on top of that, the structure of the houses should be in a way that it should show some kind of Islamic lifestyle. Generally, what we can see in today's world is people are living in the small compounds, people are living in the apartments, or maybe even they have houses. It is made on the basis or the structure which is being introduced by the West or maybe by a specific religion. Whereas when we talk about the Islamic housing and the structure of the house, when we say it should be Islamic, it means that it should have enough room for everyone. It should have enough room, enough place for the parents to live in a house. It should be having a specific place for praying. It should have a specific place for children to play and a specific place for everyone to get together in the family. And if they have some guests, so they should have a guest room as well. So when we talk Islamically, it looks at all aspects of the life within the house. And when it talks about the structure of the house, it says it should be vast in this way, that there everyone have a specific room or everyone has their own place. And for everything you have, space available in your house. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the housing in the Islamic culture. And obviously we said that the vast houses or big houses is praised, but according to the conditions that we have, so that it is not against the justice. On top of that, when we talk about the structure of the houses or the building itself, we said that it should have enough room for praying. It should have a specific room, specific place. Now, when we generally go and look at in the Islamic world, when we look at the old houses, I generally have experienced it and I really liked it, that when it is said that there should be a room for prayer, they used to have a room. Even those who go for the pilgrimage and they might have gone to the house of Imam Ali in the Kufa, and the other a'imma, like the other houses, they would have seen that there is a specific place for praying, and this place was specifically made in the houses, a kind of sanctuary within the house, or a kind of place which used to show the side of Qibla, that this is the way you need to face and pray. And there was a specific place or room, a small room, praying room in the houses previously, where people used to go and pray. And that's why when it was the time to, for example, like for Samuel to pass away, they used to say to take him to the place where he used to pray. So even in the rooms in the houses, there was a specific sign, a specific room, small room for praying. In the old Islamic culture, we can see whole houses. Maybe if you visit Iran or other Islamic countries, you might have seen this. And on top of that, the courtyard, especially big courtyards with the trees and all those things, which was a kind of peace. It was a kind of happiness. But we do not find the same peace and happiness in today's world, when we are moved into the apartments, when we are moved into the small compounds, when we are moved into the place where we are living in sharing, and this way we are harming ourselves. The stress is increasing in our life, the sickness is increasing, we are not satisfied with what we have, we do not have peace. Therefore, it is necessary to live according to the teachings of Islam. Even when you're about to buy a house or rent a house, choose a house which is according to the teachings of Islam, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Bangladesh is reviving the ancient tradition of producing a historically renowned fine hand-woven fabric called muslin. With the help of the government, the trade is making a comeback. Now, a workshop has been set up in Dhaka where weavers are being trained in the ancient art. They say it took them months to master the craft, working with incredibly fine hand-spun cotton yarns. The weavers say it takes them 8 hours to spin just 4 centimeters. Some varieties of the fabric are so fine that an entire muslin sari could fit inside a single matchbox.
There was a myth about muslin that it was so delicate that it would pass through even a small ring. Look, it's true. There is space to squeeze in another piece of cloth through this ring as well.
Breathing life back into this ancient trade was not easy. Officials with a revival project say there was little knowledge about how this fabric was made. Plus, the rare cotton variant, which makes this fabric so expensive, was also lost. The precious fabric was the most extravagant of its era and popular in Mughal courts. It was also imported into Europe for much of the 17th century and transformed the style of the aristocracy there.
An art gallery in London, Tate Modern, is hosting an exhibition with a remarkable span of surrealist works. The exhibition, dubbed Surrealism Beyond Borders, features more than 170 artworks ranging from paintings and sculptures to photography and films. Works by more than 150 artists from over 60 years are on the display. The exhibit also has a wide geographical span and includes surrealist artworks from different countries. Some of the most prominent artists whose works are being exhibited include Pablo Picasso, Salvador Dali, and Ted Jones. The exhibition will run until August 9th. Impressive, creative, wonderful. That's how visitors describe the works of Vincent Hoch, a Dutch post-impressionist painter being displayed in an impressive art exhibition in the Argentine capital. Hundreds of Van Hoch's paintings are projected onto the walls of the gallery. The image bloom and ripple in front of the audience, creating a 3D-like and immersive experience. Van Gogh was one of the most famous and influential figures in Western art history of the 19th century. He is largely remembered for his impressionist style, a break from the old traditional art technique. He is also famous for his turbulent life, which was made for outlandish, emotionally charged paintings.
Persian language takes center stage in a conference in Tehran dubbed Promotion of Persian Language on Global Scale. The event seeks to preserve the ancient language through teaching it to non-Iranians. Yusuf Jalali has more.
Persian language has been spoken for three millennia, but like every cultural heritage, it needs to be preserved. This is according to officials from Iran's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, who sat with Persian language activists to discuss ways to promote Persian through teaching it to non-Iranians.
Today is actually the Persian language day for me and for many of my colleagues. So if you allow me, I would like to continue in Farsi.
Thank you for this opportunity. The identity of a nation is a set of shared beliefs, shared culture and history, and all of these issues are reflected in the language that each nation speaks. So today, all of those who have a role in the promotion of Persian language gathered to exchange views on the preservation of Persian, and we at the Foreign Ministry will facilitate any effort made in this regard.
A thousand years ago, Iran had a poet named Ferdowsi whose poems are still popular and understood by our generation. This is significant and shows that Persian is an old language that has stayed intact through the centuries.
Sa'di Foundation is the leading entity in the promotion of Persian language. Every year, the Institute, together with the Islamic Culture and Relations Organization, holds a number of Persian refresher courses in and outside Iran for non-Persian speakers. Recently, the Institute has launched online courses and published self-study books for Persian language enthusiasts.
By launching the online Persian training platforms, we saw a sudden increase in the number of applicants from different countries. This is because many of those who are interested in learning Persian gained an instant access to Persian teaching contents. At the same time, we continue to launch in-person courses organized by Iran's cultural attaches and hosted by Iranian overseas schools.
Persian comes from the Indo-European family of languages. The earliest versions of Persian date back to roughly 2,500 years ago, during the Achaemenid dynasty. Today, it is spoken by more than 300 million people in the world, and different dialects, including Dari and Pashto, in countries such as Iran, Afghanistan, and Tajikistan. Besides its significant impact on science, medicine, and astronomy, Persian has its own prominent place in literature and poetry. Khayyam, Rumi, Sa'di, and Hafez are only a few examples of world-renowned Persian poets. Language is the identity of a nation, and through the centuries of its spoken and written history, Persian has grown to become the narrator of Iran's rich past and its ancient civilization. Now, as learning a language is learning a culture, experts here say promoting Persian on a global scale is translated into introducing Iran and its culture to the world. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
It is now well-established facts that animals feel, think, behave, and even experience pain. Thus, they should be treated with the same respect as humans, while a center in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo is doing the same, life-saving services to injured apes. The sanctuary, located in a vast national park, has been active for 2 decades. The center houses scores of chimpanzees, gorillas, and endangered great apes. Bonobos and bombos as well. Most of the animals that are brought to the sanctuary were rescued from poachers. The staff there provide medical care to the injured animals until they are healthy enough to be integrated into a group of their fellow species.
Students and staff gather for sizzling meat sandwiches as they signal their orders with their hands at a food truck in Pakistan's capital city of Islamabad. The Abbey Cow is no ordinary food truck parked on the campus of the Millennium Universal College. It's fully managed and run by staff with hearing impairments. At the beginning of the queue, a diagram shows simple phrases in sign language which customers use to order their food and communicate. The food truck is Pakistan's first mobile restaurant entirely staffed by deaf workers, providing an economic opportunity for them.
Having the startup here at our campus has been really fruitful. Not only have we created more awareness around the sign language amongst our students, but we've also created an inspiration for TMUC students to look up and pursue entrepreneurship as a career choice.
The project developer, Aisha Raza, says the majority of deaf youth end up unemployed and face inequality and discrimination. She says she wanted to create an opportunity for her brothers to economically thrive. The goal is to bridge communication gaps between the deaf and hearing communities and help remove language barriers. The food truck is the brainchild of a family where both parents and their sons are either totally or partially deaf. The 16th Fajr International Poetry Festival has wrapped up with an award ceremony in Tehran. The literary event aims to honor Persian poets from Iran and the world with the ultimate goal of elevating Persian poetry. Yusuf Jalali has more.
It's an occasion to honor poets and poetry. The 16th edition of Fajr International Poetry Festival saw its closing ceremony in Tehran, where the best Persian poetry works of the year were acknowledged and awarded. During the event, participants from Iran and other countries contended in different categories, including classic poetry, modern poetry, and children and young adults.
I won the prize for the best poetry book for children and young adults. My book is titled Silence in the Mother Tongue. I'm so glad that my effort is seen, judged, and acknowledged by top Iranian literary personalities from the jury of the festival.
Certainly, Fajr Poetry Festival is of great significance to me as an Afghan poet. Here, literary experts from Iran, Tajikistan, Afghanistan, and many parts of the world can network and make joint efforts to promote the Persian language.
Iran is known as the land of poets, being home to many world-renowned literary figures over the centuries, including Rumi, Hafez, and Khayyam. Experts here believe Persian poetry has no expiry date, and not only do Iranians still read ancient poems, they're also interested in modern prose and poetry.
Poetry is a beautiful language that speaks the beauty of the world, and such a language always communicates very well with the hearts of human beings. Iranians have long understood the beauty of this language and still listen to it and read it in its every form and genre.
Fajr International Poetry Festival was launched in 2006 as a platform for Persian poets from Iran and other Persian-speaking countries to get together for the elevation of Persian poetry. However, the literary event has grown to encompass non-Persian poets who are interested in Iranian literature.
Poetry holds a special position among Iranians, and you can rarely find an Iranian family that doesn't have a poetry book in their bookshelves. Now, aside from acknowledging Persian literary figures and poets, Fajr Festival seeks to preserve this long-standing culture and introduce it to the world. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
An endangered Mediterranean monk seal has embarked on a new solo adventure after spending months under the care of conservationists. Four-month-old Evie was released back into the wild on February 15th in northern Greece. Evie was rescued when she was only 7 days old. She had been washed ashore and separated from her nursing mother during a storm. However, conservationists found the lucky seal and started taking care of her. Even though Evie's health was poor, she recuperated quickly.
She was really dehydrated in the beginning, which is very common with pups that separate from their mothers at such an early age. And the first few weeks were critical for her health because there's basically no way to replenish, to replace the mother's milk. So we have a certain protocol and a food regimen that we provide along with vitamins and other supplements to the seal. And thankfully, in the first few weeks, she showed signs of her health status became better.
The conservationists hope Evie will be able to join a community of her species soon. They will be tracking her movements with a chip. There are only a few hundred Mediterranean monk seals left in the wild. About half of them live in Greece. And entrapment from fishing, pollution, depletion of food resources, and climate change are some of the threats facing the species.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Much of the Western mainstream media coverage of the ongoing crisis in Ukraine has displayed once again the blatant white supremacism that is still present in the Euro-American outlook onto the rest of the world. The article you're about to hear has been written by Denijal Djajic, a writer and researcher currently based in Beirut, Lebanon. He holds a PhD in American Studies. The article is titled Blatant Orientalism in Western Media Coverage of Ukraine War, and the article has been taken from Press TV's website. Much of the Western mainstream media's coverage of the ongoing crisis in Ukraine has displayed once again the blatant white supremacism that is still present in the Euro-American outlook onto the rest of the world. As many Ukrainians are forced to flee their homes as a result of the Russian intervention in Ukraine, the political and media discourse around refugees has at times been inherently racist. Numerous white Western journalists and media personalities could not hold back their outburst of Orientalism and white supremacy when reporting on the situation in Ukraine. The idea that a war could happen in civilized Europe surprised many pundits. Of course, Europe, which has caused both world wars, has waged its many colonial and imperialist wars mostly in the Third World. Besides the fact that war in Ukraine has been ongoing since 2014 and that an actual genocide took place in the 1990s in the cruel wars in Yugoslavia, the underlying assumption now was that because of Europe's alleged supremacy, the idea of war was only imaginable elsewhere in the uncivilized parts of the world. In fact, some of the current media coverage reproduces the Orientalist contrast between the civilized white Christian West and the uncivilized rest of the world. The British newspaper The Daily Telegraph published an article by Daniel Hanan, in which the author referred to Russia's actions as an attack on civilization itself. They, the author argued, referring to Ukrainians, seem so like us, that is what makes it so shocking. Stating that Ukraine is a European country, the author opposes its people who watch Netflix and have Instagram accounts to impoverished and remote populations. Reporting from Kiev, CBS News correspondent Charlie Degatta claims Ukraine is not a place with all due respect like Iraq or Afghanistan, but rather relatively civilized, relatively European. Speaking to the BBC, Ukraine's former deputy general prosecutor David Sakvaridze said, "It's very emotional for me because I see European people with blonde hair and blue eyes being killed every day with Putin's missiles and his helicopters and his rockets." His remarks remained unchallenged by the broadcaster, the BBC. These are but examples of the double standard and racist creation of difference. The rhetoric is based on the assumption that war is a natural circumstance outside of the allegedly superior European-American sphere, and that non-white people, that is the vast majority of the world's population, engage in wars because they are not civilized, not because of colonial and imperialist wars. This perspective also reveals how comfortably unaffected these media personalities must have been by all the wars launched against people in the Third World. White supremacy is the fundamental of European-American civilization. The Orientalist division of human beings into desirable and undesirable people has been structurally inscribed in dominant media discourse. The discourse around civilization not only reinforces Europe's violent racial hierarchies, but also explicitly normalizes warfare against people who do not look like the white, blue-eyed, blonde-haired European. The double standard has also been apparent in the compassionate support that some mainstream media outlets have extended to Ukrainians who took arms to fight against Russian troops. Sky News showed live on air how Ukrainians were manufacturing Molotov cocktails. The New York Post celebrated a Ukrainian soldier who blew himself up to prevent a Russian advance as heroic. Some Ukrainians have posted pictures online of themselves carrying weapons, like members of parliament Kyra Rudik. Their actions were widely praised. White victims are given moral and ideological support. Their militancy is glorified. Muslims and people of color who have organized in armed resistance are unlikely to be met with such praise. In fact, victims of U.S. imperialism and violence are themselves blamed, and their words and actions are policed. Palestinians who choose to resist the brutal decades-long Israeli occupation of their land are regularly condemned as militants and terrorists in the mainstream Western media. In fact, Palestinians do not even have to resist, as they're often by default depicted as a threat to Western civilization. Genocidal violence against them is presented as Israeli defense. The Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, is not shown as patriotic heroes, but regularly demonized as an armed terrorist organization by the same media outlets that glorify white people taking up arms. The visible hypocrisy shows the staunch perseverance of white supremacism in mainstream Western media discourse. While the media creates powerful images and narratives, it also reflects societal dynamics. The double standard in reacting to war has been manifest in the continuous discrepancy between the rhetoric on freedom and democracy and a selective outrage. While the media creates powerful images and narratives, it also reflects societal dynamics. The double standard in reacting to war has been manifest in the continuous discrepancy between the rhetoric on freedom and democracy and the selective outrage. As Central and Eastern European governments have opened their borders for Ukrainian refugees, the racialization of people fleeing their homes continues. Poland allows white Ukrainians to cross the border, but there have been numerous reports of black people being denied entry to Poland, many of which remain stuck at the Ukrainian side of the border. This adds to the continuous mistreatment of refugees at the European Union and NATO's eastern frontier. The Bulgarian Prime Minister said that Ukrainian refugees were Europeans, educated and intelligent people, unlike previous refugees who might have been terrorists. The climate for the current discourse has been present for years. Long before Russia's intervention in Ukraine, anti-Russian fear-mongering has been part and parcel of Western narratives of the common enemy. The outspoken condemnation against Russia has swiftly entailed new sanctions and boycotts, with Russian media being banned and Russians being excluded from participating in sporting events. Meanwhile, calls for the boycott of the Israeli regime by Palestinians and human rights supporters around the world have vehemently been condemned by the European Union elites for years and oftentimes smeared as being anti-Semitic. The current dynamics reveal the unfortunate continuation of Orientalist and white supremacist structures.
In Syria. The successes of the Syrian army and its allies at the end of 2014 gave the Syrian people hope in finding a solution to the crisis. But the hope did not last long because in the early months of 2015, the situation changed in favor of the opposition. In March 2015, Jaish al-Fatah announced its formation. Jaish al-Fatah was formed when a number of extremist Salafi groups like the Nusra Front and Ahrar al-Sham united. As a first step, Jaish al-Fatah attacked the city of Idlib and was able to take full control of it in a short time. Idlib is the provincial capital of the province of Idlib in northwestern Syria. It borders Turkey, and its proximity to the coastal provinces gives it a strategic position. Jaish al-Fatah continued its advances in Idlib province, and after a short time, it conquered the city of Jisr al-Shughur. With the fall of Jisr al-Shughur, the cities of Fo'a and Kafaria faced a critical situation. Fo'a and Kafaria are two Shia-dominated cities in Idlib province, which were completely besieged by Jaish al-Fatah. The residents of Fo'a and Kafaria knew that if the cities fell, Nusra Front forces would massacre everyone. That's why they resisted tooth and nail. When there was no way of delivering aid to these cities, Iranian military transport planes took over the responsibility of sending aid to the cities so that the people could resist for a longer time. The rapid withdrawal of the Syrian army from Idlib province showed that the Syrian army was incapable of confronting the forces of Jaish al-Fatah. Because Idlib